From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. The U.S. Supreme Court has handed down some big decisions in the past few weeks. We told you about the case involving Idaho's abortion law last week. And next week, we will take a deep dive into their decision on camping and homelessness. This is a case that had its roots in Boise. But today, we want to take a look at a couple of other cases, which will have profound effects on the presidency and federal rules that can directly impact our everyday lives. So here to break down the latest decisions from the court is Dr. David Adler, a constitutional scholar and president of the Alturas Institute, who is planning one of his constitutional conversations this July 8th. Dr. Adler, it's always nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much, Gemma. Good to be with you, as always.
So, Dr. Adler, the court ruled in the case of Trump versus the United States. Can you remind us of this case and what it's about?
This is the most significant presidential power decision in the history of our nation, Gemma. The court invented the doctrine of executive immunity from whole cloth in holding that a president cannot be held criminally liable for the performance of his official duties. The court drew a distinction between the performance of a president's official duties as opposed to unofficial duties, that is, personal duties, for which a president can be prosecuted, and to the broad scope of presidential power, in the view of the court, is necessary to protect against what it regards or fears as an enfeebled presidency. It wants to maintain an energetic presidency. And there's the fear, as Chief Justice Roberts said in his opinion for a 6-3 majority, that we might face a succession of administrations targeting their opponents and leaving former presidents vulnerable to prosecution by the winner of the election after the election. And so in order to protect against that, to try to provide the president with immunity, the court delivered a very disturbing opinion because, Gemma, it's with rich irony that the court clothed the president with a king-like power on the eve of July 4th, our national celebration of Independence Day, marking the American Revolution against England, which was inspired in large part because of the king's injuries and usurpations against the colonists. So to turn back the clock, so to speak, the court now has created a doctrine that has no basis, frankly, in the text of the Constitution or in the constitutional convention debates, and it has no logical premise either within the architecture of the Constitution. So this will be a closely watched decision. And as you know, three dissenters blasted the decision, including a remarkable dissent by Justice Sotomayor, who signed her dissenting opinion with the closing, "With fear for our democracy, I dissent." And I think that's where the debate on this case now rests, Gemma, as Americans ponder the implications of this decision for presidential power, for the rule of law, and for our constitutional democracy.
So, Dr. Adler, let's talk a little bit about what some of the justices wrote. You mentioned Justice Sonia Sotomayor. I also want to quote part of what she wrote. So she says, quote, "Lies about like a loaded weapon for any president that wishes to place his own interests, his own political survival, or his own financial gain above the interests of the nation," unquote. That's her perception. Then we have Chief Justice Roberts. In his perception, he indicated that the evidence in the actual case of Trump versus the United States was lacking. And here's what he wrote, quote, "It includes only select tweets and brief snippets of the speech Trump delivered on the morning of January 6th, omitting its full text or context," unquote. So what are you taking away from really these big gaps in perception?
That's a great question. I think, Gemma, that it shows the deep divide. It's an ideological divide among the justices. The six Republican-appointed justices, of course, sided with former President Trump. The other three took the other view. The first thing to note, I think, is that the dissent written by Sotomayor tells the American people that they should be very worried about the implications of the court's decision for future presidential conduct, noting that if a president engages in official conduct or something that he can characterize as official conduct, that in fact he will be immune from criminal prosecution, even if it involves violating the law. And she proceeds to check off boxes, order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political opponent, immune, and organizing a coup to stay in power. She checks the box of immune, taking a bribe to pardon someone, immune, 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 immune. It's a powerful dissent. And what her view reflects is the growing fear that a future president, perhaps Donald Trump, in a second term, might in fact engage in criminal activity and essentially become a king above the law, because the president could not be held criminally liable. On the other hand, as you point out, Chief Justice Roberts really takes the dissent to task from his perspective, for its exaggeration of extreme hypotheticals, thinking that these kinds of activities by a president, as described by Sotomayor, just wouldn't happen. And he said, if we're faced with a choice between having an enfeebled president, one who has to fear acting, as the court said, boldly and fearlessly to carry out the duties of the office, versus a president who might go too far, he would rather choose the president who goes too far. And the majority borrows from Alexander Hamilton, who in the Federalist Papers talked about the need to have an energetic executive. In my own writing and research over many years, this has been an interest, a deep interest of mine, Gemma. And the first thing to note is that while it's common for advocates of a strong presidency to invoke the name, indeed the magic of Alexander Hamilton, by asserting the need for an energetic president, they need to look very closely at what Hamilton was actually talking about. He simply meant that a president should energetically apply the law. That was the principal reason why the framers created a presidency, to enforce the law. And secondly, to carry out his duties to protect the nation. Well, that's granted to him to protect the nation in case of attack by virtue of the commander in chief. But the claim of an energetic presidency to go beyond, to even contemplate illegal actions, which will be protected from criminal prosecution, is really a disservice to Hamilton. The second point, and I think this is important for listeners, Gemma, is that a majority of this court, several members at least, spent most of their lives coming, their professional lives, coming through the ranks in the Justice Department, beginning with Samuel Alito, for example, in the 80s, where the deep concern there was efforts by Congress and the courts to restrain the presidency after Watergate. After all, given the criminal behavior of Richard Nixon, there was great anxiety in our nation to curb the appetite of a future president to engage in similar behavior. But from the perspective of those of Alito and then Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, and including Chief Justice Roberts, there was fear that the president was being harassed by Congress and the courts, and that they were enfeebling the presidency. So there is this concern about an enfeebled presidency is deeply rooted in the majority's own experience, their own professional experience in the Justice Department. I think the thing to note here in the great difference, the chasm really between Roberts and Sotomayor, is the fact that in the majority deserts its intellectual platform. As you and I have discussed previously, This is a majority that asserts the doctrine of originalism, the idea that the Constitution should be interpreted in the light of the text of the Constitution and debates in the Constitutional Convention. But let's note that this majority opinion does not cite the text because there is no textual statement about immunity for the president. And the majority does not cite any part of debates from the Constitutional Convention because, again, the framers showed no interest in clothing the president with immunity of the sort that it granted to Congress. So what's really startling, Gemma, is that the majority, which has long argued for an originalist approach to the Constitution, deserts, fully abandons that approach in this case, which provides us with the element of judicial activism, that this court wants a powerful and unrestrained executive. And to accomplish that, it will essentially engage in a hypocritical approach to the reading of the Constitution, abandoning its doctrine of originalism.
So Chief Justice Roberts also wrote that the first step is to distinguish Trump's official from unofficial actions, right? So therein lies an issue. With that said, though, Dr. Adler, when we look at what Justice Sotomayor said in regards to, you know, SEAL team, right? He now has the power to have SEAL Team 6 go and kill a political opponent. Well, Trump's not president. Biden is. These rules would then apply to him as well. So to be the devil's advocate, I mean, why couldn't the sitting president right now make a decision like that and go after a political opponent? Not saying that that would happen, but the rules apply to any president. And we seem to be stuck and focused on the fact that what if Trump becomes president and what will he do? He is not the president right now.
Well, you make an excellent point, Gemma. Given the court's ruling, in effect, Joe Biden as president could do everything that Donald Trump has threatened to do along the course of the campaign trail. And what his attorney said to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals when he said, yes, it would be lawful for the president to order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate political opponents. So we certainly could say then, as a result of this decision, that if the president, in his capacity to conduct foreign policy, let us say, decides that some political opponents here in this country represent a grave threat to national security, he could order them to be assassinated, because that's essentially what not only Donald Trump has said on the campaign trail, but what his own attorney told the court. And of course, President Biden is not of that ilk at all. He's as far removed from advocating that kind of power for the president as we might imagine. But that would, that you point up the rich irony here, that the advocates for this untethered presidency, a fully protected presidency from criminal prosecution, could come back and bite Donald Trump and his supporters. And so I think the concern here is that the court has ignored, again, from an originalist perspective, what James Madison said in the Constitutional Convention. Remember, Madison was the most important framer. He was the chief architect of the Constitution. And in describing the Article II powers of the presidency, that's the executive article, he said the goal here of the convention is to, quote, confine and define presidential power. But what the court's decision did yesterday is to leave it unconfined and undefined, because we'll now be left to guess as a nation exactly what are the core constitutional powers that that the exercise of which will protect the president, as opposed to unofficial acts. And so we're left to engage in a guessing game that creates the very kind of uncertainty about executive power that so worried, frankly, not only the colonists who rebelled against the English king, but the men who framed our Constitution in 1787. The bottom line is, there's every reason to believe now that with this kind of immunity, that the president, in the performance of his official duties, resembles the English king, who about whom English law said he can do no wrong. This president is essentially set above the law. And it reminds me of one of my famous statements from Thomas Jefferson, who warned that we should worry about converting the chains of the Constitution into ropes of sand. I've always loved that. We should worry about converting the chains of the Constitution into mere ropes of sand. And Jefferson was talking about the fact that we confine governmental powers not because we trust governmental power, but be precisely because we do not. And thus we chain governmental actors by the constitutional chains. What this decision did yesterday is it loosened those chains to such a great extent that I fear we're converting them into ropes of sand.
So, Dr. Adler, I want to switch gears now, and I want to look at another Supreme Court decision that came down recently. This one centered on what's been called the Chevron Doctrine. So first, what is the Chevron Doctrine?
This is a very important doctrine created by the Supreme Court in 1984 in the Chevron case to provide guidance to federal courts when they are reviewing administrative agency decisions, or what we know as regulatory agencies. And what the court did in that case was something very important, and legal scholars all over the map have praised it. And indeed, it was cited some 18,000 times by federal courts. It essentially provided a rule of guidance to the courts, saying, in effect, when an administrative agency is delegated authority by Congress to regulate any number of the hundreds of agencies like the Federal Trade Commission or the SEC or the FAA or the FDA, any of the members of the agencies that form that alphabet soup of government, that the administrative agency's interpretation is entitled to deference by the courts, because the people in those agencies have a lot of expertise that might be scientific, it might be engineering experience, it could be medical experience. And so because Congress has difficulty in writing precise laws in areas of great technical learning, it passes a law, let's say, to say that the marine fisheries industry is granted authority to impose reasonable rules and regulations on those fishing vessels that will traverse and fish the eastern seaboard of the Atlantic or something like that. And so the agency does that. And then if there's a challenge to it by, let's say, private individuals or a corporation, then the courts say, on the basis of the Chevron Doctrine, if the statute is ambiguous, we are going to defer to the agency's interpretation if that interpretation is reasonable. An admission by the courts that judges don't have the technological or technical or scientific expertise that people do who staff these agencies. And that's worked, as I say, very, very well. But the court, just a few days ago, in the Loper-Bright decision that you mentioned, decided to overturn the Chevron Doctrine, saying now courts are no longer permitted to defer to administrative agency decisions. Chief Justice Roberts cited the opinion and said it is for the courts to interpret statutes and resolve ambiguities, not administrative agencies. And this decision is part of a long effort by essentially conservatives to to minimize or to deregulate America, to free Americans and corporations, private citizens from the many regulations that have been developed principally since the 1930s, but going all the way back to the 1880s. And so this also represents an ideological divide on the court. The six conservatives, again, Republican-appointed justices, trying to fulfill a long, indeed, an ambitious policy goal by having justices resolve these ambiguities rather than agencies. The concern here, Gemma, is that A, judges don't have the technological or technical or medical or scientific expertise to make policy decisions. And secondly, it's not the role of judges to be policymakers. And suddenly now, instead of deferring, they are thrust into the role of policymakers. To be fair, Chief Justice Roberts said that courts can take account of what the agencies say about the meaning of a statute and how it ought to be interpreted. It's just that they cannot any longer defer to that agency decision. And so the fear here among scholars across the country and others is that there will be a hodgepodge of decisions that will create chaos across the country about what these statutes mean if they are interpreted differently through different parts of the country. And it may enormously increase the role of the Supreme Court, the load, the caseload, and the work of the court. And again, acknowledging that these justices don't have this kind of technological training.
Dr. Adler, I will be fully transparent here. This is a tough one for me to really wrap my head around, this Chevron doctrine and the implications and how it works. So with that said, can you give us a specific example of maybe how this doctrine has been used in the past and maybe, you know, the actual then concern of moving forward now with this new ruling?
Sure. Let's take the actual case here. The Loper Bright company, the Loper Bright Enterprises against the Secretary of Congress, which is Raimondo, the Secretary of Commerce, who hails from Rhode Island. In short, the Marine Fisheries Agency interpreted a statute that applied to all kinds of fishing vessels that required those fishing vessels to include monitors on their ships as they went about their business of fishing. And the reason why the monitors under the statute were required was A, to collect some scientific data, but also B, to protect against overfishing, because overfishing, exhausting the fisheries, would hurt everybody. And so we've always had regulations, at least since 1976 in this case, we've had regulations that go from American shores, not merely to the 12-mile nautical zone, but out to 200 miles. And we claimed exclusive fishing rights. And this is to protect the fishing interests of American fishermen, and as I say, to try to protect against overfishing. And these the monitors were placed on larger vessels. Well, in this case, two New England fishermen were concerned about having to pay for the monitors on their smaller ships. And so there was obviously an economic interest at stake, because under the statute, if funds are not supplied, the private fishermen have to pay for it. And the court basically said, in this case, we're no longer bound by the Chevron decision, Chevron doctrine, and we'll make our own decision. But in other cases, for example, let's think about this. The Federal Trade Commission was created in 1914, and obviously technology has changed dramatically. Back in 1914, for example, Gemma, AI was just a piece of science fiction. But now, of course, as the AI is a reality and it's fast developing and people are concerned about its development, The question is, as the agencies, the Federal Trade Commission, for example, interprets the uses and application of AI, should those people be making the decisions to resolve ambiguities on the argument that they have the expertise, they're scientists, they understand AI, or should federal judges who have no training and perhaps limited understanding about the evolution of AI or its application to American business, American commerce, be making the decision? That's really what this will come down to. Another area that could affect us all involves the Food and Drug Administration. Obviously, we have hundreds and hundreds of statutes governing the use of food, the consumption of food, and so forth. And the administrative agency, the Food and Drug Administration, has the duty to interpret those statutes to ensure that Americans are not consuming products that are going to poison us or kill us. And we rely on the expertise of those administrative agency officials. Now, if the court doesn't defer to their interpretation of an ambiguous statute, we again put that task on judges who are not trained in what kind of cereal might harm us or what supplements or whatever the product might be. So those are some real life issues for us to think about.
So, Dr. Adler, how do you appraise this current court in light of what some see really, I think, as the public's drop in confidence? I mean, we know that the public has had a drop in confidence in this branch of government.
Yeah, that's a great question, Gemma. I think the decline is obvious. I think polls indicate that only something like 38% of Americans have confidence in the work of the court. And this represents a serious threat to the continuation of the rule of law in America. Americans like to view the Supreme Court as standing above the fray, not interpreting the Constitution or resolving disputes based on ideological or partisan grounds. But increasingly, Americans are saying just that about the Supreme Court. And it's bulked by the very disturbing actions of two justices, Thomas and Alito, whose actions border on the line where they should have recused themselves, or I believe they both should have recused themselves in a number of cases. Certainly Justice Thomas should have recused himself in this decision that just came down because his wife, Virginia Thomas, was involved in the effort to promote the fake elector scheme. And so unless we are to believe that Justice Thomas and Mrs. Thomas never talk about what they each do during the day, and certainly didn't talk about the calamitous events on January 6th, he certainly knew. And that puts him in the position of perhaps not being able to render an objective decision. And what the recusal standards require is that if there's a reasonable suspicion that on the part of the public, let us say, that a justice can't render an impartial decision, then he or she should recuse himself. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And then there's the case of the Alitos flying the flags in sympathy with the insurrectionists on January 6th. So these things, among other decisions, including going back to the Dobbs decision in 2022, are deeply concerning to the American public. And that raises the question of what to do about it, what kinds of reforms we might undertake. Because if Americans perceive that the highest court in the land is not acting ethically, that it's behaving more like a political court rather than a law court, we're going to lose confidence in the rule of law and confidence in government as a whole. And so,
Dr. Adler, can I just jump in real quick? Because I only have about 2 minutes left with you, and I want to make this point real quick, and that is that every other judicial entity in the country, so every single lower court outside of the U.S. Supreme Court, is held to very rigid ethical standards, and to the point that when you mention, you know, Alito and Thomas not recusing themselves, in every other lower court, a judge would have been sanctioned if they had not recused themselves. There are ethical standards in place for every other judge in the country. And I think sometimes people don't necessarily understand that, because it seems like there is a perception overall that the judiciary is all at fault here. And is it important for people to understand that maybe what we need are ethical standards that every other judge that is a lower judge than the U.S. Supreme Court is held to?
Well, you make an excellent point and a very important fine distinction, Gemma, and it's important for Americans to understand that distinction. What we're lacking at the Supreme Court are genuine ethical rules that are enforceable. And really what lies at the bottom of this problem, I think, Gemma, is accountability. And mm-hmm. in our entire system, as James Madison explained, rests on the idea of accountability of the government to the governed, and accountability to the rule of law. And if the Supreme Court is not bound by ethical rules, and it's allowed to police itself or to simply ignore whatever suggestions there are for governing recusal and taking gifts, for example, then it seems to Americans that the court is behaving in an arrogant way. The rest of you are all bound by the law, but we're not. So I think it's incumbent upon the justices themselves to assume accountability for their behavior and to acknowledge the point you made, that like all other judges, they too should be operating under strict ethical guidelines to restore confidence in the Supreme Court. Otherwise, we'll suffer a huge loss. And so, ironically, here we are on the eve of July 4th, Gemma, and we're talking about the most fundamental issue mm-hmm. of deep concern to Americans as they launched the revolution, just as it was in the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, and that is government accountability. There was no accountability on the part of the king or parliament to the colonists. They'd had enough. Their rights were being violated. The government was acting in the most usurpacious, abusive way. They revolted. In Philadelphia, the constitutional framers sought to remedy that by, to use Jefferson again, applying the chains of the Constitution to governmental actors to make them accountable to the American people, because it's in this way that we assure the continuation of our constitutional democracy. And that's a prerequisite for all the freedoms and liberties that we enjoy, the very freedoms and liberties that Americans are about to enjoy to the fullest with fireworks and good food and parades here in the next couple of days.
Well, Dr. Adler, as always, we so appreciate your time and your expertise on this. We've been talking with Dr. David Adler, a constitutional scholar and president of the Alturas Institute. He is planning another of his constitutional conversations. It will be July 8th at 4 p.m. in Boise. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.